Welcome back to the Bonfire Podcast, where we talk about the UFC and mixed martial arts with those closest to the fight game. I am your host, longtime MMA journalist and MMA junkie senior reporter, Mike Bon. We are back, folks, back at home. What an amazing last week it was. Appreciate everyone who tuned in to an epic retirement episode with Dustin Poirier and his team. That was just such a memorable day there, getting to go hang out with him and the rest of the guys in the aftermath of course, his retirement fight loss to Max Holloway at UFC 318. That was a special one. That's going to be a hard one to top. Just a glorious week out there in New Orleans. Hope to be back at some point, but some great memories made in Poirier's final fight week. That was a blessing for him, and hope he is able to move on to the post-retirement life smoothly and seamlessly, as we discussed. But as we move on to today's show, folks, a lot going on in the world of UFC and mixed martial arts. Of course, we got a two-week run here at the UFC Apex. Not the greatest fight cards and UFC offerings, but on the tail end of that, we got UFC 319, and that is going to be a monster with Dricus du Plessis putting his middleweight title on the line against Khamzat Chimaev. And what do you know? It is a great time for the middleweight division. So much going on. Of course, we saw Robert Whittaker, the former champion, take a loss to Rainier de Ritter this past weekend at UFC Abu Dhabi. Paulo Costa beat Roman Kapilov at UFC 318, and then a plethora of other ranked fighters competing over the next month plus here at 185. So a lot is going to change. A lot is going to evolve. And here to break it all down will be none other than UFC analyst, the great coach Dean Thomas. We love having Dean here on the program, and he is back to break down middleweight from all angles here. How are these fights going to go? How are the contenders going to line up? What's going to happen in du Plessis versus Chimaev? A lot to go over here, and it is middleweight madness here on the Bonfire. No better time to break it all down. Please make sure to give the show a like, a rate, a subscription, a follow, whatever you can do. We are building here. It means a lot as we keep pushing forward here on the Bonfire. I will take a quick break now and be right back with Dean Thomas. Back here on the Bonfire, one of our favorites, it is Coach Dean Thomas, fresh off the trip to Abu Dhabi. Dean, how are we feeling?
I'm just glad. Well, so I went in Abu Dhabi and it was like 120 degrees, and now I got home and it's only like 100 degrees. So it's better than 120, but I'm still hot. As you can see, I'm starting to perspire as we speak now.
Yeah, we got some hot weather here in Toronto as well, but I know that Abu Dhabi, it's like that thick heat. A lot of the humidity, it's rough.
It's like walking into a steam room. It's like yes. Hot steam. It's awful. It was miserable.
How was the trip otherwise, though?
No, it was great. Highlight? The fights were great. They treat you really good. UFC is always great. So yeah, it was worth it. I mean, I complain. You know how it is. Like when you got it good, you find things to complain about. That's what it is, man. I'm just complaining about nothing.
Yeah, for sure. No, we've done the Abu Dhabi thing a lot of times too, so it's a familiar territory over there at this point. But I don't know. Like, I thought it was a pretty decent event. Obviously, we'll talk a lot about the middleweights here today, but outside of the main event, what do you think from that fight card stuck with you the most?
Honestly, just because I'm such an old generation guy that when I see older fighters do well, I get excited about that. So to see Davy Grant pick up a win. Yeah, to see Davy Grant pick up a win. And that was special. Who was the other old head?
Muslim Salikov.
Yeah, Muslim Salikov. Yeah, Muslim Salikov. And his call out to Wonderboy was the rightful thing to do, because there's nothing worse. Mike, I got to tell you, there's nothing worse to me than when a 25-year-old up-and-coming fighter calls out an older guy because they got a name. Nothing screams punk to me like that. Like are you... If you think that you him, call out the other dudes that are in your bracket. Don't call out the older dude because they got a name. So
is that not the game though? Like you gotta try to at least get some of those guys.
That's the game, but it's not you to do that. Like the promotion is supposed to do that, and you're supposed to accept it because it's like, all right, they're gonna give me this one. I'm gonna accept it. But that's not the call out. That's not the call out. The call out is another young, hungry, up and coming guy.
Yeah, you call out the killer and hope they give you the old guy.
Yeah, but for Muslim Salikov to call out another guy who's only one year older than him, it was a perfect call out, especially coming off that knockout. That was good. And then I got to say, Bryce Mitchell was brilliant. I mean, Honestly, Mike, going into this fight, I didn't think he was going to win. I was like, man, I didn't think he was going to make weight, much less win. I didn't think the fight was going to happen. But I saw him hours after the weigh-in walking around a hotel, just as vibrant, clicking his heels like he had just won the lotto. And I was like, yo, I had to change my pick. And he went out there, had a tough first round, but despite that, pulled off the win, just out-dogged, outworked Saeed Nurmagomedov. It was brilliant.
Yeah, can Bryce Mitchell be anything at bantamweight? It's such a deep division, so many guys that are so freaking good. I'm sure he can do that to some dudes, you know, grind them out, but there wasn't much of the way of, like, threatening to finish that fight, and you're going to have to bring some of that against some of these dudes at one time.
No, the reality is this, is that these guys go drop weight looking for sort of a magic pill or the answer, and the reality is this, if you can't win in the top five of your division, you're probably not going to win in the top five of the division under you either. So it's not necessarily a size thing that's holding you back. You think it is. It's really kind of a skill thing. And once he gets up against those top guys in the division and bantamweight, he's still going to struggle. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, it's so tough. I mean, to sit here and say anyone is going to be a dominant champion or a champion with Merab sitting there and all those good guys, it's a tough ask.
What it will do for Bryce is it might allow him to beat guys at bantamweight a little easier, the ones that he can already beat. It's going to allow him to beat them a little easier, but he's still going to struggle with the top guys.
What did you think of the stoppage or lack thereof in that Stephen Wynn fight against Muhammad Yahya with the record number of knockdowns?
Yeah, first off, they only credited him for 6. I'm still saying 8. I mean, if a punch was thrown,
a couple of them seemed off balance, but I don't know. Sure, go ahead.
If he might have been off balance, but the punch was still thrown. You know what I'm saying? Yes. If a punch is thrown and it hits you, whether you slip or not, it's a knockdown in my eye. I was okay with it. Now, I generally don't side with these moral victories in terms of, yeah, he's at home, blah, blah, blah. I generally don't care about that. But this is a situation where we're dealing with a guy who was fighting in his home country, his area. He probably went to school like 2 miles from there. You know what I'm saying? Everybody was there to see him fight. He's got no wins in the UFC, probably on the verge of getting cut. He was trying to fight his heart out. So I was actually okay with this. And the fact that he can go out and say, you know what, I didn't give up. I didn't quit on myself. They had to stop it. I'm okay with that. You know what I mean? Like, and I think he's going to be okay with that as well. Like, if he had, like, gotten stopped because it was that bad, he wouldn't have been able to eat that as well.
So you don't think, you don't put much blame on Jason Herzog? You think he handled that?
No, not at all.
In the days after.
No, let's leave the referees alone. You know, they got a job to do. They do it better than us, or else we will be paid to do it. So they have a job to do. When it's too early, they criticize us. We criticize them for it being too early. When it's too late, we criticize them for it being too late. So let's let them do their job. And sometimes they might make mistakes. Who knows? Maybe Jason Herzog will look back at this and say, yeah, that was a mistake. But for now, let's just say it is what it is, and let's let them ride out with that.
What do you think the mentality of someone like him here is like a few days after that too, right? Because he had the controversial Derek Lewis versus Tolson Totara main event as well a couple weeks ago, and everyone thought he stopped that too early. There was the cage grab, all that weirdness. Yeah, and then you have a thing now where everyone's saying it's too late, and that's got to get in your head to some degree.
Yeah, we gotta just let them do their job. And what happens is when we start criticizing them, now they start making overcorrections. They go into fight stand, oh, I don't want to stop it too early. And then we end up with situations where they stop it too late. Or if they stop it too late, now they're stopping fights really early. So we got to just accept the result, whatever the result is. Let's just accept the result and then just say, you know what, let's put it behind us and treat each fight, you know, independently. And let them make the decision according to each fight. And let's stop giving them a lot of crap for that.
I think, too, if you want to get into criticisms of how that all played out, you could also point to Yahya's corner, right? I know everything you said there is accurate, his home country, desperate for the win after being 0-2 and all that stuff. But I wonder at what point is the corner when you see your guy getting knocked down the third time, the fourth time, the fifth time, the sixth time, then your mind, the seventh, the eighth. When do you say, okay, bud, this is not your night?
And it might be a situation, who knows, man? Maybe he's just got bad balance. You know what I'm saying? I mean, he was getting knocked around, no doubt. But
his eye definitely showed that the damage was there.
The damage was there, but it wasn't like every time he got knocked down, his eyes were rolling back in his head and he was coming back through. It was more situations where it's like he's getting touched and just dropping. And then he's getting right back up. He's dropping and getting right. So, like, that might be a situation. He's just got really weak legs and bad balance. And he don't take punches well. Who knows? Maybe his corner knew that. Maybe in practice, like, he gets stung and he drops a lot. So, like, that might be a situation.
Yeah, maybe. It's definitely interesting just because there's only been three fights now in UFC history where there's been a guy getting knocked down five or more times. So it's like extremely rare. And I saw people asking about like a knockdown rule in MMA. Obviously, that's nothing even worth really talking about because that's not the sport how it's built. But it was a weird one because you just don't see that many knockdowns in a fight. Usually it's stopped or the person's out.
Yeah, I was more so giving him credit for getting back up every time. Like the fact that it wasn't like he was getting dropped and needing time to recover. Like he was pretty much getting back up immediately, like as soon as he could get back on his feet. And then he dropped when he come back and dropped. Yeah. I mean, he was still throwing hard. So my thing is this, like you stop fights, referees are supposed to stop fights by definition when a fighter can no longer intelligently defend himself. So if that's the case, this fight shouldn't have happened at all because my man wasn't defending himself intelligently from the beginning.
It's true.
So
it's true. Go ahead.
No, so I'm saying, so like you can't use that as the reason for stopping a fight.
It's a tough one, and you don't see ones like that where it's dragged out for so long very often. Have you ever been in the corner in a situation where it was either a corner stoppage or you guys were debating having to stop the fight yourselves?
No, and I mean, again, I'm old school, dog. I'm not one to throw in a towel. I'm not one to throw in a towel. I mean, you got to know your fighter, but I'm not one to throw in a towel. Like for me, if you sign up for this, you know what the risk is. You know what the risk is, and you have the option to get out. Now, you might not want to because you feel embarrassed by it, but that's on you. So for me, if you a fighter and you sign up for this, you know when you want out. So go ahead and pull the, you know, hit the button. You can press the button. Come get me. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? I'm tapping. Come get me. So you can do that too.
Yeah. He could have just laid there and looked up at the ref some of those times.
You know what I'm saying? Like if he did not want to fight anymore, he could have laid there. This is the sign. When guys turn over to their stomach and ball up.
Yeah.
You turn over to your stomach and ball up, you're saying, come get me. Somebody come stop that. He never did that. He got back to his feet and was throwing punches. He never did that.
The Bob Sapp special, I think we called that.
Yeah. Just ball up. Yeah.
Hit once and ball up. Yeah. Well, that was definitely, I think, one of the more interesting results of the night. But of course, the most like meaningful, was the main event. And of course, that's coming right in the middle of all this middleweight madness, as we're titling this episode, Dean. Just so many middleweight fights, recent results. Of course, it kind of really started with Paulo Costa's win at UFC 318 as far as like ranked guys. We had Brendan Allen as well on that card, getting the win over Marvin Vettori. That led into this card where Rainier DeRitter got the split decision over Robert Whittaker. On August 9th, we have the UFC on ESPN 72 main event between number 8, Roman Dolidze, Roman number 9, Anthony Hernandez. That's current UFC rankings. Those might adjust by the time you're listening to this. UFC 319, Jared Cannonier against MVP. Then Dricus du Plessis versus Khamzat Chimaev headlining. And then 2 weeks after that, Nassourdine Imabov versus Kyle Baralho headlining in Paris. And then on October 4th at UFC 320, Abus Megamedov, who's 14 currently, fights Joe Pyfer. So we're going to get a lot of stuff happening. I think I see here only three guys not booked in the top 15 or like didn't fight in the past 2 weeks. So this is good stuff right now, Dean. This is the movement you want to see in a division. I guess let's just start at what we saw this past Saturday. What did you think of the fight between Rainier DeRitter and Robert Whittaker? Do you think, I guess, first of all, the right person won?
I thought the right person won. I thought Rainier did enough to win the fight. I thought, and I wasn't counting rounds. I'm not a judge, but I did think he did enough to win the fight. And I'm not one to go back and watch it again. It's just in real time as I'm watching this fight, I thought that he won the fight. In fact, I was a little surprised that it was a split decision. So one judge obviously thought that Robert Whittaker won the fight. But I'll say this, though. Robert Whittaker impressed me. I didn't think that he still had that much left in him. We spoke to him on the pre-show the day before, and he seemed to be in a really good place. And oftentimes when guys are in a good place, they're also sometimes you can't be fooled by that. Sometimes they're in a good place and they're okay with like giving up on themselves and quitting and just being like, you know what? I've had a great career. And he went out there in that fight, and somewhere I think in that second round when he got hurt really bad and he got his back taken, I was like, I actually texted RJ Clifford. I said, I don't think Rob recovers from this. And he recovered. Mm-hmm. He got back and he looked even fresher. And I said, I had to eat my words. And I said, while sometimes when you see a fighter in a good place, that could also mean that they're in a good place in terms of dealing with adversity in fights and not wanting to quit. And so that's what it looked like to me. And even when the result was red and he lost, he still seemed to be in a good place. And I like this for Robert Whittaker because he's not sour. It didn't seem like he was complaining. He wasn't pointing fingers at anybody. He knew what he was in that fight, and he knew it was a tough fight. He knew that, you know, it wasn't a dominant performance, so neither fighter could complain either way. But I was really impressed with Robert Whittaker and his ability to just to withstand those hard times in the fight and still seem to have a lot of positivity left and still have a lot of confidence in his ability to win.
Yeah, he's in a very interesting spot, and we can get into what his future looks like a little more in a bit. But, you know, like 34 years old now, he said his sixth kid is on the way and wanted to make this like kind of the beginning of his final title run. So a lot of questions, I guess, how much.
But that's it too, like having six kids, right? So like when you're coming up and you're fighting for, you're coming up, you're fighting for your heart and you're like, yo, I want to fight because I want to prove that I'm the best and I want to beat these guys up. Then when you start having a bunch of kids, it starts becoming about, man, college. I got to pay for college. I got to get this money. Right? What's that?
You have to fight.
Yeah, you have to fight. Yeah, you have to fight. Like, you have to fight. And there's pressure on you. And sometimes that can motivate you. But in the trenches, I'm sorry, kids. In the trenches, you're like, yo, these kids can go to public school. You know what I'm saying? Like, right. In the trenches, you're thinking about, you know what I'm saying? We don't have to have an extra babysitter. You know what I'm saying? So in the trenches, but in the trenches in this fight, Robert Whittaker still seemed to be able to bounce back. And I like that for him. I thought that was inspiring.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. What about Rainier's side? I mean, this guy, 4 UFC wins in 8 months. He made his debut in November. Here we are at the end of July, and he is arguably one of the top contenders in this division, maybe even the next guy. Speaking of resiliency, he comes back from that crazy knockdown in the third, like just relentless pressure. Those knees were awesome. I mean, how impressed have you been by just this rapid rise and his performance and overcoming that knockdown too?
Yeah, he's a good fighter. There's no doubt about that, man. He's a really good fighter. Dare I say, even a great fighter. And more than anything else, man, he was lucky enough, and this was just by chance. And I'm not saying that he did anything to receive this favor, but by chance, he had like really good matchups to get where he is right now. Mm-hmm. Like, had the matchups been a little different along the way, you know, especially like going into the UFC for your first fight. Had he not had Gerald Mershart in his first fight, a guy who's similar to him, but a little smaller, you know, a little maybe even slower. Like, that was a really good matchup for him to allow him to not have the UFC jitters. And he still had them, but not have them and have a big effect on him. Like, had he had Joe Pyfer in his first fight, like, things might have been different for him. But he had Gerald Mershart. And then his second fight, he jumps on Kevin Holland. Jumps on him, chokes him out. Again, building his confidence along the way. And then he fights Bo Nickel and is able to get that main event experience against a guy who doesn't really have a lot of experience and dominates him, gets the knockout win over that. So, and then he fights Robert Whittaker in another main event. So, like, his trajectory has just been laid out in a really good way that he was able to grow into it along the way, as opposed to like jumping out. Like, Aaron Pico was like, he's not getting, you know what I'm saying? Like, Aaron Pico was not getting it. Like, Pitbull didn't get it. Like, but no. Rainier de Ridder has gotten away with just like really favorable, not easy matchup, but favorable matchups to grow into his spot.
Yeah, he's done a great job. His team, you get rewarded for activity, for being willing to take all the fights. I mean, momentum is a very strong thing, and he has all of it right now, and it can carry you to really big opportunities. And you know, I guess it depends where this does lead him, right? I guess we could skip right ahead to the title fight. We could break down
Why not?
I mean, what? So I guess let's make the argument here. I mean, if Dricus du Plessis wins, I think he's got a very good chance. Everyone wants to see DDP versus RDR. Just the weirdness of that fight, I think, would be so compelling to watch. I think he's got a great shot. If Khamzat wins, I don't know where they go with him as far as the first defense.
Yeah, I actually think, well, here's the thing, man. Timing is everything. Injuries play a factor in this. When guys need to fight other divisions, all that, when they need to have headlines, so on and so forth. And I'm just arguing for the case of RDR getting the shot, but I don't want to do that right now because I really do believe that the winner of Caio Bahio and Imavov should get the title shot next. I really do believe that. I know what RDR did was great, but you can't dismiss with what Caio Bahio did and what Imavov did, and then the fact that they are fighting each other and not sitting around and waiting. Like, you gotta really give them a little credit and say, you know what, you guys deserve it.
I agree. I do agree on paper. I just wonder, it doesn't seem like the UFC is like super high on Nasruddin. Like, just
no
way,
hell no. You know, he's
yeah, it was a struggle to get this fight with Caio booked. He was originally the backup for the title fight. Now I saw today, I have not confirmed, but I saw Red Corner MMA tweet that Caio is going to weigh in as the backup and then fight a few weeks later now. So I don't know where this all went, but if Nasruddin wins, unless he does something super highlight reel, I feel like the door could be open for RDR to sneak in there and be ahead. And it's tough to say. I mean, like, they both have the win over the legend, right? Like, he got Izzy, RDR got Whitaker. I don't know which win is more valuable in 2025.
Well, I mean, so with Imavov, the fact that he had to remind everybody how to pronounce his name is a bad sign. That's always a bad, like, you can't fight for a title when no one knows how to pronounce your name. Like, it's just, you can't do it. Like, you need, in fact, you need a nickname. Like, even with like Reiner de Ritter, like, we can't really say his name right, so we just call him RDR. You know what I'm saying? We give, when you get a nickname or a shortcut to your name, that's when you know you're ready for a title. And Imavov ain't got that. Like, that's the unfortunate situation. And in fact, like, every time I say his name, I have to think in my head to make sure I get it right because I don't want to be disrespectful. So while I'm saying he deserves it, it's just like, man, it's hard for the powers that be to put you in a spot that you're going to sell pay-per-views or get eyeballs on attention when you're not that dude, when you're not a big seller like that.
Yeah, and I guess if we want to do like a hard reset on that, going back to the title fight, like, what do you think? If Khamzat wins, is Dricus done enough to get an immediate rematch? Do you think he just clears all these guys and it's going to be like, okay, well, you thought you might be next, we can talk about all this, but you're all going to get slid back one spot because
Dricus
is going to fight for it again?
No, I'm going to keep it 100 with you. If Khamzat wins, it's a disaster, actually, because, you know, You can't tell me that a part of you is just like thinking this fight actually might not happen.
Of course. Let's say like Khamzat's been in the United States for, I think, like a month now. He's training with Sam Calavita, who is, you know, an extraordinary strength and conditioning coach, worked with Pico, working with Armin, I think right now, TJ Dillashaw for years. Sounds like he's doing all the things right and he's here. So unless I think he might be doing like an open workout for media in LA like next week or something like that. I don't know if that's confirmed. So like the fight week motion is happening here, but I guess of course we've seen things go disastrous at the last minute. So something's in the back of the mind, but I don't know.
These guys are just habitual in terms of not making it to the dance. And there's a part of me,
this one though, right? He's got to be dead.
Well, no, I'm not going to be pessimistic about it and say he's going to show up. But my point is that if he does show up and he does win, do we trust him to be able to fight again? You know what I'm saying? Like, that's the thing, is like, can he do it twice, two or three times? Because we need movement. Like, I hate when it's just like static, when there's no movement in these divisions. And in order for there to be movement in the divisions, the champions have to fight.
Correct.
And
if there's a lot of contenders and all these guys are going to want their chance. And if the title isn't defended until Abu Dhabi next October or something, right? Like 14 months from now, then we have some serious problems.
And I know they don't care. It's not like they're sitting at home. Like the only person who ever cared, there's two people who ever cared about it in the history of the UFC, Jiří Prochazka and Jamal Hill. They were like, you know what? I ain't going to be able to defend it, so y'all go ahead and take it back. Outside of that, champions are just like, nah, y'all going to have to strip me then, dog, because I'm, you know what I'm saying? I'm going to hold on to this because I worked too hard for it. But at the end of the day, like, we need to have movement. And if you're a champion and you're not willing to fight regularly or when they need you to, it's bad for the division. It's bad for the sport, actually.
So, okay, let's try to be optimistic here, I guess. Let's say Khamzat wins and he is ready to defend the title in January, February, March or something, like a normal schedule. Do they go back to the Dricus rematch?
Or no, you don't go back. You don't go back to the Dricus rematch. You insert somebody else. You insert This really could happen in Paris. That fight be a snooze fest.
Sure.
And then you just put RDR in there. Right. And that's highly probable that the Imavov Bahayo fight is going to suck.
I don't disagree. I think it's very on the table. It would be more out of character for Caio than it would be for Imavov at this point.
Imavov is difficult to fight. He's stubborn. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? He's a stubborn guy. Like he's not going to give you anything. He's not going to give you much. And when you're faster than everybody, you can do that. Like you can sit back and wait and be like, yeah, you know what I'm saying? Come get it. And that's how he fights. So it could be very boring. As long as he gets his win, he's going to be like, oh, give me a title shot. And then we're going to be like, dude, I don't know, man. I don't know.
I mean, I feel like if Khamzat wins, they're trying to go for the biggest stuff, right? Like, I just can't imagine a scenario where the first fight is Chimaev versus Imavov.
No.
I just have a hard time seeing it. And I don't know. He's obviously deserving, and I'm always in favor of the meritocracy. But I saw someone suggest, and it hasn't got out of my mind. I don't agree with it. I don't think it makes any sense in the world at all. But if Chimaev wins, is there a world after his win at UFC 318 where they do Paulo Costa versus Khamzat Chimaev for the title after all their years of beef?
No.
And fight at
there's
the
no. There's no chance that they put a guy in there who's
unreliable dudes
in his life. I mean, there's no chance that they put Paulo Costa in there. I mean, it would be nice, but if Paulo Costa could eventually rack up a nice couple dubs and then put himself in a situation where that happens, or here's the most likely scenario for a Chimaev Costa fight. Chimaev loses.
Mm-hmm. Oh, easily. Yeah. That's the layup next move. Yeah. Yeah. Probably wins that, gets back on track. Yeah, I just wonder. And I said in response when I saw someone say that, I was on Submission Radio. It was another reporter, and I said, like, if they were going to go in the direction of a undeserved title shot beef grudge match thing, why would you not just do Khamzat and Sean Strickland? You know, like Sean Strickland's right there; he's the higher ranked guy. I know he's coming off the loss, currently suspended from that issue at the Tough Enough event where he rushed the cage, but like, they have their history, and at least you know when Sean Strickland signs that contract, he will show up to the fight.
Yeah, he's definitely going to show up to the fight. How long is he suspended for? Does anybody know?
It's a temporary suspension, so I think at next month's, the August Nevada Commission meeting, they'll revisit it and either address his punishment, which will be something official, resend the suspension and say, you know, you've served your penalty in terms of time and the fine you paid. I don't know what the number on that was. So I don't expect if UFC said we want to book Sean Strickland for the December pay-per-view or something, the Nevada Commission is going to prevent that from happening.
Oh yeah, this is nothing. And so if it's temporary, this is nothing. It's just, they're just trying to set an example to say, listen, if you do something like this, we will get you. And they're just using him as an example because it's high profile.
So I don't know. I'm still not seeing the clear answer there. I mean, I feel like any of these guys could get the shot. And of course, it's performance dependent, especially if Khamzat wins. I mean, all the doors are going to be open. UFC is going to want to cash that cow as much as they possibly can. So it's going to be interesting. But I guess flip it to the other side. If Dricus successfully defends, what do you think the direction is there? Is RDR most likely the guy? Or do you think, like we said, is an Imavov title shot any more appealing or likely if Dricus remains the champion as opposed to if Khamzat wins it?
I mean, I'm pretty sure they're hoping Imavov loses. So that's not even in the options, right? So you sure. hope that he loses. So like either way, you just hope that you just kind of wipe him out by a loss. And if that's the case, Bahio for me still is the top contender and should get the shot. Now, if that fight is boring, which again will probably be that, then you go with RDR. You go with RDR. You can make that case, and you could probably do it sooner. Well, Drinkus does have a history of injuries, but hopefully he doesn't get hurt too much. So you could probably even do it sooner rather than later. You give RDR, you know, both of these guys probably need a little break, but you can do it sooner rather than later. But I think that's a fight that sells. I mean, you got two guys, both, like RDR said, you know, Drinkus has Dutch heritage. So, like, even though I thought he was African, you know what I'm saying? I'm blown away. I'm like, yo, he got Dutch heritage. I thought he was African. No, but I think that you could make that fight happen. And I think that's probably the biggest draw in terms of what people would want to see.
Mm-hmm.
So
here's my outside Drinkus du Plessis scenario, which I think is not crazy, but a lot of stuff has to break. If he beats Khamzat, I think it's fair to say, like, he should be able to call a shot, give this man whatever the hell he wants, right? Like, he's, I think, cleaned out all the top guys. There's a lot of talented fighters, as we discussed. But as far as, like, you just beat this guy who everyone thought was unbeatable. Call your shot, man. What do you want to do? And he's mentioned a fight with Alex Pereira a few times. If he wants to go up, and if Alex beats Magomed Ankalaev and regains the belt, I think a Drinkus du Plessis as champion coming off a win over Khamzat is more appealing than Alex Pereira versus the Prohajka versus Roundtree winner. All these fights we've already seen. I don't think they would do a trilogy with Ankalaev right away. If Pereira wins, he's probably going to get shooed to the side a little bit. So I wouldn't rule that one out.
But do you think that the organization would risk their champion going up and losing, even though it is at a different weight class with nothing at stake? Like, is that worth it to them to risk that? Like, for just kind of a showcase fight?
It depends. I mean, what you see Drinkus says, right? Like, he's young enough. He seems very dedicated to all this. And if you feel he can be a big star, if he beats Khamzat in some remarkable way, and you're like, wow, this guy can be really something for us. If he goes and beats Alex Pereira after Khamzat, even if he commits full time to 205 after that and leaves 185 behind and all these guys to fight as they seemingly may make him do with, you know, stripping all these champions.
I think if
I'm Drinkus and his team, like, that seems like way more appealing to me than defending your belt against Nassourdine Imavov or Kyle Bralho or RDR.
I think they would let him do it if they think he has a good shot at winning.
Do you think he would? I think he'd have a good shot of beating Alex Pereira.
We never thought he had a good shot of winning any of these fights.
And especially if he beats Khamzat, if he goes out there and dominates him and finishes him, I mean, I think our outlook on him will be different than is sitting here right now today.
Like, in order for him to beat Khamzat, I do believe he's got to show us something. Even though he's always shown us something a little different, he's always, like, shown us improvements, and we've still put that label on him as being really sloppy. He's not as sloppy as we've labeled him to be. Like, he's a little stiff, but he's not as, like, his technique is bad. Like, his technique is not bad. He's just a little stiff. But I do think for him to beat Khamzat, he's got to bring out some things that he may have never done before. And if he can do those things, it would probably prove the case that he could beat somebody like Alex Pereira. And if he wanted to do that, I'm here for that too.
I think that would be an appealing one. He'll have the options at least. Let's get into this fight a little bit, though, from the X's and O's. Like, I have not heard anyone give an opinion who, you know, their opinion I respect on this fight between DDP and Khamzat, where it's like, you know, if DDP can get through the early storm and drag it to the fourth and fifth round, then you never know. He might gas him out and finish him there, or Khamzat's just going to get him really early. Is the analysis here as simple as that?
No, I don't think it's as simple as that.
Different layers, dude.
No, it's not as simple as that. I mean, it's low hanging fruit there. But I do think if you want to take other low hanging fruit, I really do believe this comes down to DDP challenging Khamzat on the floor. You have to be able to grapple with Khamzat if you want to have any chance of winning. That's the reality of it. You know, all these guys, they try to get away from him. Use my distance, get low, use my distance, defend the shot. He's going to get you. He's going to get you. You have to be, you might as well get it out of the way. I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't think it's a bad strategy or even be surprised if DDP shot on him. He might not get the takedown, but you got it. You got to show him that you can grapple with him. Like, if you think, like, if you want to trade with him, make him feel like that's the only option of winning. Right. That's why, in fact, it was playing at the gym today. Gilbert Burns and Hamzat was playing at the Goat Shed this morning. The reason why Gilbert Burns had so much success against Hamzat is because when Hamzat took Gilbert down, Hamzat felt Gilbert's hips moving in his guard and said, nah, I'm straight. I'm good. Right. I don't need to play this game. And it was a striking match. All these other guys, they start trying to get up. Come on, get up, get to the fence, get up. And all he does is take your back, dump you down, take your back, dump you down. And in order to be successful against him, I believe you have to show him that you can grapple with him and show him that maybe you're a better grappler than him. And if you're a better grappler than him, you limit his options and you start to break his confidence, because, like, I believe that's his crutch. Like, the fact that he can take anybody down, that's a crutch.
Is it, I mean, as a coach from that side of it, I know you said you got to kind of meet the grappling with some counter respect there, but, like, if your Drickus runs out there, takes you down in the first 15 seconds and climbs to your back, like, what are you doing there? Are you just trying to ride out the round and not make a mistake? Are you trying to explode out of there? Like, what do you think is the best move if he does find himself in worst case scenario in that first, like, minute?
If he gets Drickus's Drickus's back in the first minute, see, I thought he was African, right? but if he gets Drickus's back in the first minute, that's a bad sign. That's a terrible sign. A lot of things went wrong there. A lot of things went wrong. Like, first you got taken down, and then you allowed him to give up back access. You can't give up back access. Like, that's just it. Like, this, you gotta have a strong defensive until your offensive guard. Like, you gotta have a guard. You gotta be able to, if you get taken down, incorporate your legs into your guard so that you can fight him off. Like, these guys, when they turn over, their legs are no longer a part of the equation in their defense, and then he just jumps on your back. That's a bad sign. So, you know, you can chew up some time. You might lose the first round, but let's chew up some time. Don't give him your back. You can't give him your back. That's worst case scenario.
Yeah. What do you think would be the most impressive way for Hamzat to win? Would it be just doing what you said there and finishing that technique? Or if he can, like, go to a war and win a 5-round decision where, like, he pulls away, you know, the fourth and fifth round after it's close, like, and would that be more impressive to you than finishing it early?
No, I think him finishing early would be pretty impressive. Yeah. You know, a guy like Drickus, who seems to be extremely confident, and he always fights to his highest level of intelligence. And he fights good fights. And if he gets taken down and his back taken and that series of bad things happen and then he gets finished, that's pretty hard to do against a guy like Drickus. So I'd say that. Like, if he gets outworked, then I would just say, you know what, Hamzat is he showed us something different. Mm-hmm. You know, he's better than we thought. Like, everybody criticizes his cardio. And who knows, man, maybe it's not a problem. Maybe it's a pacing issue, and maybe he's fixed that in practice. So, so if he outworks Drickus, I'll be okay with that. But if he finishes him early, I'll be like, oh no.
Yeah. We'll see how the cardio goes with this Sam Calavita link up. What about on the other side? What would be the most impressive form of Drickus to win for you?
If he finishes Hamzat early. You know, what if he finishes Hamzat early? Maybe he might clip him. You know what I'm saying? Like, he's got some really sneaky head kicks. He might clip him with a head kick and shake things up and then get the fight stopped. You never know. Like, it's that would be pretty special. And if he did that, I'm like, yo, fight Alex. But if he finished, for real. Yeah, we expect here's in our head, the low hanging fruit of this fight is that if Drickus wins, is that he gets beat up for the first two rounds. He gets his back ridden. He's holding on for dear life. He almost gets finished. The round ends miraculously. He survives. And then it happens again in a second. And then we start to see Hamzat get tired. And then we start to see a shift in the fight. And then next thing you know, Drickus comes back all sloppy. And both guys are sloppy. And then Drickus just outworks him in the last round. And then wins a decision 48-47. You know, like, that's what we see in our head. That's the little hanging fruit. It's possible. It is possible. But I think that that something different can happen. I think that, you know, something different. I'm hoping that something different happens. You know, this is the MMA gods have a way of surprising us.
Yeah. What way are you leaning? Who do you think's going to win the fight? I'll give you, obviously it's a few weeks away, so I won't bind you to this prediction. You have the right to make changes in the next few weeks based on what you see.
I actually think Dricus wins. I think Dricus wins. I think he beats him. I think he wears him out earlier, actually, than even like going into the fifth round. I think he could probably get a stoppage somewhere in the third. I think that, and not necessarily like weathering the storm, but just matching the pace, maybe being a little more efficient in areas. And then just, we start to see Khamzat slow down a little bit and then Dricus takes over earlier.
Yeah, that would be fascinating to see if it plays out that way. And it would be fascinating to see how Khamzat would digest a loss, because he spent a lot of years there just mocking other fighters who had lost, you know, with memes and stuff on social media. So he's set himself up for a lot of backlash if it doesn't go his way. So we shall see. A few other things before we move on from this middleweight madness, Dean. On that same card in Chicago, as I mentioned earlier, Michael Venom Page fighting his second fight at middleweight against former title challenger Jared Cannonier. MVP said after the Shara Bullitt fight that he was going back to welterweight. This was kind of like a one-off. And then here he is getting the number seven ranked guy. So, like, I don't know. We don't need to talk too much about it. But do you think MVP can be anything here at middleweight? Like, if he goes out there and wins impressively, where does that even put him?
Yeah, same thing what I was saying about Bryce Mitchell in terms of MVP. MVP is going to have the same level of success no matter what division he fights in, whether it's heavyweight or welterweight. I think he's still going to be good and still be a problem for everybody he fights just because his style, and he's still so good at that style. And it makes sense for him to risk going up to fight the number seven guy. A guy who's in his 40s, who's relatively short, and MVP's relatively tall. So you're dealing with a guy who's shorter than you. He's in his 40s, and just it's a stylistic nightmare for Jared, actually. So, and I've spoken to John Crouch about it. I was like, man, I mean, this is a tough one, man. Like, this, the same situation that he had against with Peter Yan and Marcus McGee. Like, it's a tough one. Like, you're just dealing with a tough matchup, and this is a tough matchup for Jared Cannonier. Like, dealing with a guy who's super tall, who moves really well, kicks well, it's hard to get inside on, and it's a real tough fight for Jared.
It'll be interesting, because MVP will likely be bigger than him, you know, when they do the face-offs in the cage, and he used to be a welterweight, and Jared Cannonier had multiple fights at heavyweight in the UFC, which is wild to think about, you know, spanning four weight classes meeting in the middle here. So that's pretty wild. I guess final touches here, as the guys we've talked about who aren't booked right now, there's number two, Sean Strickland, number four, Israel Adesanya, number five, Robert Whittaker, number 10, Brendan Allen, tied for 11 are Marvin Vettori and Paulo Costa, and then 15 is Roman Kapilov. If you were to pair any of the combination of those guys up, is there one fight between those names that you think would make the most sense?
I think, you know, we talked about, and we never really established what we do with Robert Whittaker at this point, but I think you give him Roman Kopolov.
Interesting.
I think you give him Kopolov before you start feeding them to the guys, right? Before we say we're done with you and we're going to start feeding you. I think we give him, because Kopolov's kind of in the back, right? Like, is he 15 or something like that? So you give him Kopolov to say, all right, we're giving you number 15. You win that, we keep you up here and we'll keep you fighting these guys. But if you lose that, now you got to fight the up-and-comers, you know. So I think we give him Kopolov. And then if you do have to give him an up-and-comer, you go out of that and you could give him somebody like Shabazzian or somebody like that. But yeah, I think you give Whittaker one more chance at the top 15.
If you had to bet, do you think Robert Whittaker ever fights for a UFC title again?
No. If I had to bet, I wouldn't assume he gets there. No, it's interesting, though, because he said he had a four-fight plan to get back to a title. Now it looks like it's going to take about four fights because with a win over RDR, it wouldn't have been four fights, right? It's like another win and you good. But now, like, maybe that was his plan. Maybe he was like, you know what? I'm going to lose this one and then bounce back.
Yeah, I mean, there's a fight card in Perth, I think in like late September or October, that has his name written all over it. If he can make a turnaround that quick, that would be quite the place to make a statement. If you can get someone to fly over there that far, those Perth trips are never fun, Dean. It's
Kopilov, dog. Kopilov. Give it to Kopilov.
Yeah, he'll take
that. He got to fly somewhere anyway. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's close to Russia. It's not far. He can do it. I think he trains in Vegas, but whatever. All good. Before I let you go, Dean, they announced three big championship fights for the month of October, UFC 320. Of course, we get the main event, Alex Pereira, looking to regain that belt from Magomed Ankalaev, the co-main event. The run of Merab Dvalishvili, the amazing guy who we predicted at the beginning of the year would not be champion by the year's end, fighting Corey Sandhagen. And then at UFC 321, finally, clarity on the heavyweight division. Tom Aspinall puts the belt on the line against Ciryl Gane. Of those three, we don't have to get them all. Which one do you want to talk about the most? Which one is most intriguing?
Tom Aspinall and Ciryl Gane. I think the implications of that are the biggest of all the fights, and they almost transcend the UFC in itself, because that one is attached to John Jones, who transcends the UFC in itself. And I have to assume this is a nerve-wracking spot for Tom Aspinall, because he talked himself into a position, and we've all talked him into a position where he's the best guy. And John dismissed him. And then John dispatched of Ciryl Gane. So anything less than a first round finish is going to be almost a disappointment for Tom Aspinall. Even like a close win is going to be like, see, I told you, I beat that guy in seconds. This is actually a pretty tough spot for Tom. Like, it's, if this fight had happened earlier, maybe indifferent, but this is a tough spot for Tom.
I totally agree. It's super fascinating. To your point there, John Jones, I think, finished Ciryl Gane in 2 minutes and 4 seconds, and Tom Aspinall's average UFC fight time is 2 minutes and 2 seconds. So
he's got to beat that. He's got to get the average. He's got to get the average.
Yeah, it's a lot of pressure though, man. Like, not even on top of the in-cage stuff to deliver, like, him carrying this event. I know he specifically asked, he wanted to be on this card in Abu Dhabi. He didn't want the taxes of New York and the time change of Vegas and such, but like, this is going to air afternoon stateside. Ciryl Gane isn't going to do shit to promote this fight, I don't imagine, or at least nothing that makes it exciting. And it'll be, I'm sure, a decent card, but afternoon time, it's just like, it's not something you feel like the MMA world is going to have to like stop an appointment viewing, right? Unless they really stack the deck. He's going to have to work for that to make it happen. Like, it's not just a layup of a international fight week main event in Vegas or something where, you know, the attention is built in. So we'll find out how many people, I guess, care about Tom Aspinall and whether this whole John Jones thing like elevated his recognition and interest.
That's always the tricky part, right? Because especially fighters, more than anybody else, they always think they're more important than they are. And we'll get to find out. We'll get to find out how important he really is. But a win here could really make him important. You know, like a win, like a big win against Ciryl Gane in Abu Dhabi, and he grabs that mic. That's going to be the most important minute of his entire life, to be like, yo, I just beat the guy that you beat. I beat him in 2 minutes and 2 seconds. And now I want to fight John Jones at the White House. It's written.
Do we even care about that, though? I mean, the comment Dana made to me after the last press conference in New Orleans, where I asked him, you know, like, John coming back. And you saw that quote,
yeah,
right?
I saw the quote, but it doesn't matter if it happens or not. It doesn't matter if it does happen or not.
Sure.
But the idea of him saying it, just attaching himself to the situation, because now there's no deny. I mean, now what would John Jones's rebuttal be? Like, and he can't say anything. So it's like, that's the biggest thing. And even if the fight doesn't happen, you know, Tom Aspinall just goes on his run. If I'm Tom Aspinall and John Jones dismisses me, I'm going on a run. I'm beating up Derek Lewis. I'm attacking Jaltan Almeida. I'm going after all these guys and just creating my own lane. But to say that to John Jones would be the nail in the coffin to me, to John Jones's rebuttals.
Yeah, that's true. I also think there could be power in just not even mentioning him, right? Just be like, hey, like, I just beat the crap out of this guy, Derek Lewis, you're next in January, and then maybe I'll fight at the White House, and you don't even say John Jones's name or anything. That would probably trigger him.
Yeah, that would
than being mentioned.
That would definitely trigger him. That would certainly, like, there's John Jones would be all over Twitter.
Yeah, it'll be very interesting though. As when I was kind of talking about this too earlier, like Tom Aspinall never headlined a pay-per-view before in the UFC. Mm-hmm. He's been co-main event a few times, so like we're gonna find out what he's really all about here. But as I say all those things, the challenge of, you know, being in Abu Dhabi after the card, if he goes out there and does something spectacular, like ESPN might post the full fight video, the full highlight, like all that stuff, and you get the attention of anyone anyways. So he needs to do something big, it feels like, though.
Well, he's capable of it, and that's the good news. You yes. know, we're not asking, you know, we're not asking a female strawweight that, listen, you need a knockout. You know, we're not asking for that. You know, we're asking of a guy who's extremely capable of knocking people out and submitting people early to do something that's on brand with him. So it's very likely that this could happen.
For sure. Well, I think that does it for our time, Dean. We stopped short. We ran out of the clock before we could break down Tatsuro Taira versus Hung Sung Park in our new main event on Saturday. But
thank you. I appreciate that. I'm not working this card, so I couldn't break it down for you anyway.
I was teasing you. When is your next one? Do you get a little break for these Apex cards?
Absolutely
in Chicago?
Or, you know, as no? we speak, well, tomorrow, well, Wednesday, I'm leaving to do UFC BJJ. And mm-hmm. then I'm working the Apex card with Fluffy versus Dalidze. So,
and then off to Chicago. I'm very excited for that one. Yeah. That's going to be great. Pico and Lerone Murphy, a great co-main as well. But so much going on, Dean. I always appreciate you doing this. I'm sure you're jet lag from Abu Dhabi and everything. So go rest up, get ready for UFC BJJ this week. And I appreciate your time as always, man.
Thank you for
being
here
on the Bonfire. All right, gonna take a quick break and wrap things up. And that does it for another edition of the Bonfire Podcast. Thank you so much to Dean for coming on once again. Always appreciate his time. Thank you to my man Kamikaze Abi Suban for producing the show. Thanks to you all, as always, for watching and listening. The support means a lot as we try to keep growing here and continue to show it with comments, follow, subscription, share it with a friend, anything we can do to try to gain more traction on this program. We'll only help build things, get the better guests, maybe get some more sponsors, all that type of fun stuff. It really means a lot, the shows of support. That does it for now. A great show already cooking for next week, but until then, we will see you right back here by the Bonfire.